living other lives through fiction.
I think to write a range of characters, you have to let go of your vanity. There's the question of, what if someone knew that I even had these thoughts or was thought or knew how someone like this would think? And I love to let that go.
That's Francine Prose. We talked to her about her new novel about the immigrant experience in America, My New American Life.
It's wonderful to be able to live this second life through the fiction, and that a reader can experience that to some degree also, not just writers. That we live these other lives through books, and we test those other lives, and we go down other paths. And then in our real life, we don't necessarily have to take that path anymore.
And that's David Vann. He explores his own family's dark history through the transforming crucible of the novel. It's called Caribou Island. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, airing here and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. What's it like to come from Albania, liberated not so long ago from a paranoid communist dictatorship, into an America that seems to be falling under a kind of paranoid dictatorship of its own? That's the question Francine Prose's novel My New American Life poses. Set during the Bush-Cheney years, when being an immigrant became increasingly precarious, My New American Life is told in the sardonic voice of its spirited young protagonist, Lula. She lands a job as nanny to the overprotected teenage son of a Wall Street executive. Then trouble comes when three unsavory characters from her homeland show up to ask her to do something that could endanger her application for citizenship. It all serves to shine a light on America through the eyes of an outsider, one who, despite her jaundiced view of human nature, still displays a very American desire for reinvention. Francine Prose, we've interviewed you now. This is going to be the fourth time I've interviewed you on Writer's Voice. We talked about Reading Like a Writer, Golden Girl, and Anne Frank. This is a completely different kind of book. Even though it's a second fiction book, it's a very different kind of fiction book, very different in style and tone. First, just give us a setting. This is the Bush-Cheney years. Why did you decide to write a book that was around immigration and this time?
Well, I really had the character in mind before I had anything else in mind, and I knew I wanted to write about an immigrant nanny living in New Jersey. That's mostly what I knew. And then, of course, I began to think about it, and I thought, immigration, it's such a huge issue now and continues to be an issue. And also, when I started writing it, it was just around, when I started writing it, it was near the end of the Bush-Cheney years. And then as I got into it, it was as if the minute Obama got elected, all those years had never happened. People just instantly forgot what it was like here. You know, and it was so difficult, and it was especially difficult for immigrants, of course. I mean, the way things changed radically after 9/11, and also at the time I was teaching, I was teaching a class at Baruch College in New York, and I had these wonderful students, most of whom were not American-born, and many of whom had visa problems of one sort or another. And their courage and their spirit and their brilliance was so inspirational that all the stories they told me just went directly into the novel.
I've heard you talk about their brilliance. You said they were all geniuses.
And also, you know, I should say that this novel, actually, it's unlike the last three books, but it's very much like the four books before that. I mean, Blue Angel and A Changed Man. I mean, Golden Grove really was the only sad novel I've written in, I don't know, 20 years. And I thought, boy, I never want to do it that again. So this was sort of a return to something that was, at least on the surface, very funny and very lively. And I was entertained writing it. So, you know, Golden Grove was not particularly entertaining to write. So it was a great pleasure and a relief to me, really, going back to writing something that made me laugh out loud when I was writing it, and I could only hope would do the same for the reader.
It did have that effect. Golden Grove, on the other hand, I found was a very powerful in the sense of the ability to really move the emotions here. Could you talk a little bit about the difference between writing on that level and this?
Well, you know what? It's really the same, because finally, it's for me, it's just about the sentences. You know, writing great sentences and rewriting until the sentences are the way I want them, and you know, writing for rhythm, for example, which I'm very conscious of. But Golden Grove was about very much about one family, and then, you know, radiating out from that about the subject of grief and tragedy and how you go on after a personal tragedy. Whereas in My New American Life, I really was trying to talk much more about certainly this one character, Lula, my Albanian immigrant nanny, but also about the culture. I mean, one of the things I like about her, and one of the things that I'd noticed myself, was the way in which kind of end-stage capitalism, which is what we're dealing with now, is like Eastern European communism. You know, and Albania was the most extreme and the most psycho and the most isolated dictatorship. And the things that those cultures have in common, I mean, she's in a unique position, perhaps, to realize the weird, unexpected ways in which New Jersey, 2005, is like Albania in the years before that.
Say a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, the idea, I mean, the idea really came to me. I was staying in some chain hotel, supposedly a high-end chain hotel in Florida. And when I got there for the weekend, there was a tray of food outside somebody's door. And when I left at the end of the weekend, it was still there. And I thought, this is just what it used to be like in Eastern Europe, where I traveled a lot, especially in the late 80s. I was in former Yugoslavia for almost 6 months, and then have been there again. You know, because basically no one cares if you come back to their restaurant or hotel, because it's state-owned, and there's not a, you know, there's no personal pride or even profit, really, personal profit. So I began to think about the ways in which my experience in Eastern Europe was like my experience traveling around the United States right now. And when I was thinking about Lula, I thought, oh, perfect, just, you know, create someone who's smart enough and funny enough to see those bizarre, but I think real similarities.
And similarities also in terms of what's happening to our democracy?
Yes. Well, sure. You know, I was talking to my son the other day, and we were talking about, I was talking about nostalgia. I know, somehow I've been thinking about nostalgia, and I've been thinking about nostalgia as a sort of conservative impulse. You know, it used to be better, the city used to be better, da, da, da. And I was saying, you know, I'm going to stop saying that New York was better in the 70s and 80s, and now it's all these heartless condos and so forth. And my son said correctly, but you're not talking about cultural evolution, you're talking about a corporate takeover. And it's true. You know, I think that part of the anxiety that's just thrumming through everything, I mean, friends, and I've been talking about this with friends over the last few weeks, is this sense of doom that's ever, you know, I mean, the towns are getting, what was it, 20 tornadoes touched down yesterday in North Carolina and, you know, Wisconsin, all over the South. And everyone knows that something is happening, but people can't find ways to express it. So I think part of my job as a writer now is to find ways of talking about that, those forces, without being preachy or polemical and being funny and entertaining, and yet, you know, finding a way to say, look, something's happening here.
It's ironic. I had this discussion with someone who wrote a young adult novel recently about the post-carbon future, Paolo Bacigalupi, about a time when, you know, the oil has run out and there's a corporate takeover and there's a tiny elite and everybody else is just desperate. And I asked him that question, and, you know, he said he felt like he had to tell the truth to young people.
Oh, well, of course. I think, you know, so many of us feel that way. Why isn't anyone saying this? Why aren't people making a connection or helping other people make the connection between, oh, let's just say climate change and these tornadoes? I mean, it's certainly very real. So the novel was great fun to write, and it was funny. But underneath it all, I had a sense that there was something that I had to say about a direction I feel that we're headed in.
Mm-hmm.
Or have headed in, and maybe we're just, you know, about to fall off the cliff. I don't know.
And you were opened up to some of this through the experience of talking with your students there. Mm-hmm. Did their stories move you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, their stories move me. My daughter-in-law, who is originally from Mexico, has been working for years teaching Mexican students in New York. So that was a whole other source of stories that were very moving. And it's very difficult for these kids and very, you know, I mean, my new American life, when I got to the end, I thought, this is a strangely optimistic book compared to the way I actually feel, because Lula is just kind of driving into this probably bright future with all sorts of hope and optimism and humor and da-da-da. So, and that still exists. I mean, that still exists. And that's the thing that I still love best about this country, actually, and am determined to hang on to. I mean, I had, speaking of students or immigrant students, I had an experience. I went to talk to a class in the Bronx in DeWitt Clinton High School, and this was an honors high school class, in a pretty tough school. And the kids were from everywhere. They were from everywhere. And speaking of geniuses, when I walked in, they were talking about Jonathan Swift, and, you know, they got it completely. So, you know, that part of our culture and that part that Lula is still involved in, which is making your way here as an immigrant and finding a place for yourself, I think that still exists, regardless of what, you know, they're calling for in Arizona, which is to get rid of all the immigrants now.
And she also meets some pretty generous, kindly people. Her boss, who might be neurotic, but he's pretty kind.
Yeah, Mr. Stanley, her boss, who works on Wall Street, who is a sort of model of sad sack, neurotic American parenthood, you know, but genuinely loves his kind of difficult son and has hired Lula to take care of him, even though he's 17 and doesn't really need to be taken care of. And then Lula's being helped by her immigration lawyer, who's not only her lawyer, but is working on Guantanamo cases. And I wanted Guantanamo there in the background, because the more I worried that the book was too optimistic and too patriotic, I thought, you know, it's good to have a little shadow of what was actually and is actually going on. Just cast that shadow over the bright, sunny optimism of assimilation into American culture.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. You're hearing an interview I did with best-selling author of fiction and nonfiction, Francine Prose. I visited her in her New York apartment to talk about her latest novel, My New American Life. It's about a young immigrant from Albania who casts a comic and acerbic light on the immigrant experience in America during the Bush-Cheney years after 9/11. I thought you worked a very powerful paragraph in there about Guantanamo. There's a point in the book, and I don't want to give too much away, where Lula goes to the lawyer and tries to spin a story about her boyfriend. And he's just right on her case.
Yeah, no, the lawyer is saying correctly, you're bothering me with your hood of a boyfriend, and I've got these horrible things that I'm dealing with in Guantanamo. Oh, you know, P.S., that prison still exists. P.S., there's going to be military tribunals after all. So, you know, again, it's like something that we should be saying 24/7.
So Lula also is a wonderful storyteller. In fact, My New American Life there's a kind of a literary device here. Why did you make her a storyteller?
Well, she's a storyteller and also a bit of a compulsive liar, because her lawyer and her boss have decided that she should be writing a journal about her old life in Albania and her new life in the United States. And because she finds out very early that if she makes up these stories about Albania that are really stories about Albania 300 years ago, but because no one, as it turns out, knows anything about Albania and they're perfectly willing to accept as modern life in Albania. So she just spins these kind of legendary, mythic stories about her home country, which her boss and lawyer just go crazy for. And part of what was fun about writing them was, you know, as entirely sympathetic as I am with the boss and the lawyer and people like them, in which I include myself, you know, there's something about their eagerness to not only help, which is a good thing, but to think of themselves as helpers and people who are doing good and trying to spread the American dream around and so forth, that was just kind of fun to play with, even though I'm just like them in certain ways. You know, I certainly wrote have written a lot of letters in my time to help people get visas who deserve visas. So I'm, you know, I've done it and I believe in it. But there's something about, what do I want to say? The little edge of self-satisfaction in there that was just fun to have fun with.
And that comes from not having actually experienced the same thing as the people that you're helping.
Right. And in fact, I went to Albania for 2 weeks just to check it out because it turned out to be impossible to imagine. I mean, no matter how many times I went on YouTube, I just was not getting what it was like to be there. So I went, and actually partly on a State Department-funded trip to Albania. And it was fascinating. I just completely loved it. I mean, it was amazing. And one of the things that I'm so happy about that this book is I'm getting to go to a party for 700 Albanian Americans and sometime in May, because somehow the book got through. So, you know, with music, I mean, you know, the music is great. The food was spectacular. And so I feel that this is sort of my new Albanian life to go along with the novel.
So we mentioned the would-be boyfriend. There is this plot twist here. It seemed like a very strange thing that just suddenly came out of nowhere. I don't know how much you want to say about it, but maybe you could just give our listeners a little bit of the story that drives this novel forward.
Well, I guess I can say about it because everything I'm going to say takes place in the first 15 pages, so it's not exactly a spoiler. I mean, maybe it spoils the first 15 pages, but not many of them, which is that these three Albanian guys show up, as you say, out of nowhere in a big SUV, and they ask Lula to hide a gun for them, to keep a gun for them, and their presence and their return and the tension of having that gun in the house and her evolving crush on the one who she calls the cute one of the three guys is part of the kind of plot mechanism that drives it forward. And there's a gun in the house. So, you know, as Chekhov says, if there's a gun, you know, if there's a gun in the first act, at the beginning of the play, the gun should go off. But, well, you know, a friend of mine said, oh, a new definition of experimental fiction, the gun doesn't go off. Well, you know, there's a gun. That's all I'll say.
Now, this is your 16th book of fiction, is that right? And as I said before, we've spoken to you about three other kinds of books. You've written in many different genres, young adult novels. You've written fiction, nonfiction, magazine articles. I guess I'm having trouble figuring how to actually frame this question, but I'm curious about what it is like for you to move to different genres. I mean, you just said before or earlier that it's about the writing. Mm-hmm. Are there differences in writing in different genres, or is it all the same process for you?
Well, it is about the writing, and it is about endless revision. I mean, frankly, writing novels is a million times more fun. And you know, because you invent it and you have this whole world of the imagination and this other world that you're entering into. I mean, you know, I've been thinking on and off that at some point I do want to write a kind of sequel to Reading Like a Writer. But beyond that, I would be surprised if I wrote another nonfiction book. I never want to do another bibliography again as long as I live. I mean, it's just, you know, and even though I can hire people to help me, nonetheless, I have to, you know, vet it. I mean, there are just too many things about it that are tedious, that aren't there when you're writing a novel. It's never tedious. I mean, even I love last stages of revision in writing. You know, I love the part where you take the comma out and put the comma back in, which is very different from having to track down a reference that you remembered what it was when you were writing it, and then, you know, you're finished with the novel and with the nonfiction book, and you can't remember what it is. So I, you know, it's hard to talk about it because I'm too superstitious. But I'm writing a novel now that started off as a nonfiction book, and I said, actually, I want to do this as a novel. It's much more fun, and believe me, it's much more fun.
I asked Francine Proves how she gets the details down that give verisimilitude to a piece of fiction.
There's a kind of mystical element, which is that it's almost as if every story has a way that it wants to be told, and it's up to you to kind of discover that way. I mean, you know, technical things, am I going to write this in the first person or the third person or the present tense or the past tense? Or, you know, in some cases, fiction or nonfiction, but my own experience is that you can just make up things. I mean, I will say that in the book I'm writing now, there's a scene that takes place at the Berlin Olympics in 1936. Mm-hmm. And there's one thing about writing the Berlin Olympics as history, which has been done a million times. And another way to write it from the point of view of a character who's actually seeing it, which is quite different. So I can, you know, watch the Leni Riefenstahl film and pretend I'm that character and have a very different experience. You know, because part of writing fiction for me, the fun, is pretending you're someone else. You know, you don't get to have more than one life simultaneously. I mean, who knows about sequentially. But you know, while I was writing my new American life, I was this 26-year-old, wisecracking Albanian girl living in New Jersey. And that was great fun.
And also, did you then step into the shoes and be the father, the lawyer, the kid?
They're all me. I mean, you know, believe me, there's nothing that can be said about neurotic parenthood that I haven't experienced firsthand. So, you know, that was easy enough. And as I said, you know, all those kind of do-gooder impulses that the boss and the lawyer have, I certainly have. And even the disgruntled, withdrawn 17-year-old son, that was me too. You know, I was that kid. I mean, everything, and it's about being 17. Everything's annoying. The adults are all out to just give you a hard time for no reason. Your future just couldn't seem bleaker, you know. So, and I just funneled that all into the character of Zeke.
Have you ever had a character that you had real trouble inhabiting? And if so, how did you work your way out of it?
Well, not really, because, you know, I think to write a range of characters, and it's something that I find weirdly easy, even though, I mean, you have to let go of your vanity. You have to let go of your vanity, because you can't, one of the things, I mean, there are many things that get in the way. One is, you know, what if my aunt blah blah reads this and recognizes herself and, you know, oh my God, there's that. But then there's the question of, what if someone knew that I even had these thoughts or knew how someone like this would think? I love to let that go. You know, whatever. Obviously everybody has these thoughts. They run through people's minds. And why not get them down on the page?
That's Francine Prose. Her latest novel is My New American Life. Prose is a president of Penn American Center. Her novel, Blue Angel, was a National Book Award finalist, and another, Household Saints, was made into a movie. You know, I'd like to ask you, I think of you as a writer's writer, maybe because of Reading Like a Writer, which was a very influential book for me. It started me reading books with the thought in mind, paying close attention to how things were written. And I guess, first of all, I'd like to ask you, is there any literary influence that influenced you in the writing of this book and the other books that you've done that are similar to that?
I read all the time. I read when I'm writing. So I don't, but I'm never, you know, I'm never quite sure. Although, you know, it's funny, especially in the book I'm working on now, I'm reading a lot of history, and I'll read a history book and find a character who I think I've invented, who's already in the novel, and I'll go like, how could I possibly have known that? I mean, it has a kind of Twilight Zone quality. So, and the same with, you know, when I wrote My New American Life, when we went to Albania, I did meet people who seemed to me rather like characters I'd invented, you know, the three guys and so forth. I met, you know, one of those three guys, I met him when we went to Albania, and I thought I just made him up, but there he was. So that certainly happens. But in terms of writing, you know, as I said in Reading Like a Writer, I have a shelf of books, you know, a fairly large shelf of books that I just open at random because the writing is so good. And I'll just say, okay, I'm getting lazy. Let me look at a sentence of Charles Baxter's stories, who writes so beautifully. And it will inspire me to go back and work harder, really.
Mm-hmm. Charles Baxter.
Mm-hmm. Charles Baxter. Oh, well, his new and selected stories, Griffin, just came out, I guess, in January. And it's amazing. It's so beautifully written. And the stories are so complicated and so deep. I mean, everybody should just read it right away.
That reminds me of how you helped to bring a book to American readers that has been had been hidden for so many years. That's Hans Kielsen's book. Which one? There were two of them, actually.
Comedy in a Minor Key and Death of the Adversary. Yeah, I mean, you know, the Times sent me them to review, and I was saying, you know, because I just, the Anne Frank book had come out not long before, and I was really, I felt sort of ground down by having been on a book tour and having had to talk about the Holocaust all the time. I just, you know, and I was saying, well, I don't know. And they said, read it. And the minute I started reading it, I did think these books were masterpieces. Apparently, I've, you know, my name is being mentioned on the Dutch version of Oprah because, you know, American writer discovers this guy who's been there all along, and suddenly he's 101 now. He's a superstar in Europe. So, you know, I couldn't be happier.
It's true. Actually, I'm pretty good friends with his wife, and I've met Hans Kielsen. Yes.
Really? Oh, how amazing.
And when I called her up after I saw the interview, she said, oh my God, you know, we never expected to have so much attention. The people are all saying, well, this is in the New York Times.
Isn't that strange? I mean, an American newspaper, that you need the American newspaper to bring attention to the Dutch writer who's been there, you know. But fine, however it happened, fine.
So you were just awarded, actually a pretty big award, 2010 Washington University International Humanities Medal for Lifetime Achievement. You're incredibly prolific when I think of lifetime achievement. So I wanted to ask you, what is your ability to put out this kind of amount of work, especially given what you've told us here, which is that you also put in a tremendous amount of revision?
Well, you met my husband. I mean, and he's a painter, but he also does everything. I mean, I don't do, you know, I can only do, what is that saying that, you know, the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one thing? I know one thing. I can write, but I don't, you know, I've lost my ability, basically. I garden. I mean, I'm close with my kids, but I can't cook. I can't drive. I mean, the book, as you can tell, is obsessed with driving because I can't do it. You know, I can barely operate, I guess, a coffee machine maker is about the extent of the machinery that I can operate. So I feel blessed in a way that many of the responsibilities of just being a living human person, he's taken on for me. So that, you know, that certainly frees up a lot of time. That has a lot to do with it. And also I can read in a moving car. So that's been hugely helpful to me because I can, you know, do research or books I have to review when someone else is driving. So it helps my work time.
And it's not a discipline. It's something you just want to do. Eagerly.
I like to write. Mm-hmm. I like to write. I mean, it's, you know, it's, which isn't to say that there aren't terrible days or months or weeks or years where you just think, I can't do this. It's too hard. Why did I even bother? I should have been something else. But you know, for that one good day, it's all worth it.
And what kind of tricks do you use, if any, to get over those difficult times? Or do you just kind of let it lie fallow until it's ready to come?
Yeah, there's nothing like time. You know, just leave it there. Something will, or wait for something to happen in your real life that informs the thing you're doing and that you can use in some way.
Well, Francine Prose, I look forward to reading your next book, and I'm so glad that you came to talk with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
Francine Prose. We spoke to her about her novel, My New American Life. You can read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. You can also hear my interview with Marita Kielsen about her husband, Hans Kielsen's book, Comedy in a Minor Key. Francine Prose reviewed the book in the New York Times. Next up, we talk to David Vann about his novel, Caribou Island. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. David Vann's fiction has dealt, one might even say been obsessed with, the terrible events of his own family's history. His acclaimed story collection, Legend of a Suicide, recounts the events of his father's suicide when Van was 13. His great-grandmother also took her own life. His novel, Caribou Island, reworks some of this family history into a profoundly moving exploration of family breakdown. It's set against the backdrop of the beautiful wilderness of southern Alaska, where Van was born. Caribou Island, which came out in 2010, became a bestseller in the U.S. Until that time, Van had been better known in Europe than in his native land. The Irish Independent compared him to Jonathan Franzen, saying, Van might even be more worthy of the title Great American Novelist. This is your first novel, Caribou Island. You are the author of is that a collection of a short story or a collection of short stories? Legend of a Suicide?
Legend of a Suicide is a short novel framed by five stories. And they all are set in Alaska and Ketchikan, where I spent my childhood.
And both of these books center around a suicide in the family. The first one is, well, they're both autobiographical in some ways. They both take off in some ways on suicides that happened to your family. When you were 13, your father killed himself. Could you say a little bit about just the circumstances of what happened and how that became part of your first book?
Sure. Legend of a Suicide has a true story in the background, which is my father's suicide when I was 13. And in the book, everything has been transformed a bit. The main part of the book is a short novel titled Suquan Island. And in that, the boy and his father go homesteading for a year. In real life, my father and mother divorced, and I moved down to California with my mother, and my father went back up to Alaska. And he asked me to come spend a year of school with him in Fairbanks, Alaska, which would have been eighth grade. And I said no, and then 2 weeks later is when my father killed himself. And so I always felt really guilty and wondered if I had said yes, if my father would still be alive. And so in that short novel, the boy says yes and goes and spends a year homesteading with his father in Alaska. And so that's the relation that the true story has to the fiction, I think. I think it powers it, and it comes from my guilt and my loss. And it also, it's been transformed into fiction in that Suquan Island is 50 miles away from Ketchikan, and I've never actually seen Suquan Island, but it's the forest that I know really well from Ketchikan, and it's the same water and everything that I know from that childhood that's still really mythic in my imagination. When I was a kid in Ketchikan, as I'd go running around in the rainforest, I always felt that I was being watched and being chased, and we actually had wolves and bears there, and I could fall through the forest floor to a second floor because there was so much deadfall and so much undergrowth, and just disappear. And that was a kind of amazing place to grow up as a kid. And so that's the landscape that I'm working on, both in Legend of a Suicide, in that short novel, Suquan Island, and now in this new novel, Caribou Island. And it's a landscape that shifts and changes shape when I put pressure on it. But in each case, the previous book and then this new novel, Caribou Island, I'm shifting to a different location than Ketchikan. Caribou Island is actually much farther up in Alaska on the Kenai Peninsula, a very different part of Alaska. But I still carry my sense of Alaska from that childhood, I think.
And the land has, a stark beauty to it. It's quite the background to the lives of the characters in this novel. In this novel, you have a number of different points of view. You have, I think, the main narrative arc is around the couple Gary and Irene. We see them in the beginning of the book as Gary is bringing his wife out to a nearby island just off the mainland, where he plans to build a cabin. We already have a sense that this is a marriage that there's a sense of foreboding and doom about it. And tell us what's going on. Tell us about these characters.
Well, it's definitely a story of a marriage going wrong in the wilderness, and I think there's a tremendous amount of pressure put on the characters by the fact that it's set in the wilderness, and there's nowhere to go, there's nowhere to escape. They can't escape themselves. I view wilderness as being like a bare stage with mirrors all around, and they're already in a remote enough location on the shores of this lake, Skelak Lake, but now Gary wants to move them out to Caribou Island, which is even more remote. It's a place that you can't get to in spring or fall when the ice is forming or breaking up in the spring, because when the ice isn't strong enough to travel across and yet too thick for a boat to get out to, there'll be no way there. And so Irene wonders why Gary wants to go to such a remote place, but her sense is that he's building this cabin as a way to leave her, that by the time this cabin is done, he'll have found his excuse to leave her. And that's what she thinks it's really about. He thinks it's about finding the idea of Alaska that's been deferred for 30 years because they had children and they were distracted by work and other things, and he feels like he's finally getting to realize the dream.
He's kind of a hapless guy, but not hapless in a goofy, innocent way, but in a way that's pretty dangerous.
Yeah, and I think that this is a little bit like me and my father. Both of us have thrown ourselves into projects where we weren't really qualified or quite competent. My father became a commercial fisherman in Alaska as a last desperate attempt before his suicide to create a more self-determined life. But he went to sea without a captain who had any experience. He just went with his brother. The two of them had only sport fished. And they almost died out in a March opening in the Bering Sea for halibut when a long line became caught on the ocean floor. And they were in 30-foot seas and having to hack ice off of the bridge of the boat. It was a nightmare, and they really almost died there. The drum crumpled, and they had to cut it free and barely made it. And for me, I've built boats also and repeated my father's life to some degree, and I always think that the boat's going to cost half as much and take half as long to build as, in fact, ends up being the case. And so when Gary goes out there to build a cabin, he plans to build it with no plans or experience or permits, no advice, welcome, and that's how I would do it, I think. and it's it doesn't turn out well, of course. It doesn't work out smoothly for him.
No, it doesn't. Not only because the construction itself doesn't work out so well. And I mean, you have some almost they're both painful and comic at the same time. I mean, you know, the old carpenter's saw, as we call it, you know, measure twice, saw once, is not something I think that Gary's ever heard of.
Yeah, there's very little measuring going on. He just throws himself at it, and it becomes at times a labor of impatience, sometimes rage, sometimes despair, and it's really how he's worked on his marriage in some ways too, which is that he hasn't put any thought into it at all. He just got married. It was convenient. It was easy. She was available, but there's a way in which he's used her life without any kind of thought about whether the marriage was actually something he wanted or something that was a good fit or what it would be or what his role would be in it. It's been pretty unconscious there also. So the cabin and the marriage are definitely brought together in Irene's mind, at least. She's making comparisons.
Yeah, he's almost like a Captain Ahab character. I almost felt like the cabin was his whale, and he was Captain Ahab.
Yeah, that's pretty good. It is a bit like that.
Yeah. Now, you just said before that, you know, in some ways you were repeating your father's history with some of the ways he threw himself at things without a whole lot of preparation. And by the way, I want to say that probably most of us are like that, or many of us are. I mean, we do kind of go through life just with an image of how things are going to turn out and without really thinking more carefully. So, but in another darker way, you also had some fears about, you've talked about
right.
Having a sense of doom.
Right. For 20 years after my father's suicide, I really did have the strong sense of doom that I was destined to repeat what he had done. And I imagined that everything would go fine for a while, and I'd get married, I'd have kids, I'd have a career of some sort. I didn't know exactly what that would be, but I imagined at some point that I would start cheating on my wife, and I would lose my wife and kids, and I would spiral into despair just like he had, and that I would hit a low point. And once I hit that low point, that suicide would be the option. And I used the word doom because that's really what it felt like. It felt like it was just hanging over me, that it was just waiting, that no matter what I did in life, like Oedipus, I could run this way or that, but I would end up just squarely there. That's where my final point was. And that was an awful kind of feeling. It took hitting a real low point in my life to realize that, or find out that that wasn't true, that I wasn't interested in killing myself. So I had to hit a really low point where I had nothing, no job, no prospects. The future just looked worse and worse. And then I realized that I wasn't thinking about suicide. I just wasn't. It wasn't who I was. So I finally felt free from it in a low point that became a high point because of that release.
So you had a kind of epiphany that you are not your father's son.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And the epiphany was very directly that I'm not him. Like, I'm not my father. And that was such a release. His act when he killed himself, it was so shameful to begin with. For 3 years after his suicide, I told everyone that he had died of cancer, because what he had done it just seemed so violent and ugly and shameful. He did it while talking on the phone with my stepmother. He told her, "I love you, but I'm not going to live without you," and put the pistol to his head and pulled the trigger. And this was after he had broken up that marriage, just as he had the marriage with my mom through infidelity. So it had been his fault. And they had also tried to get back together, and he had blown that also. And then finally she was moving on with her life. She was going to be with someone else, and he calls her and says, "I love you, but I'm not going to live without you." And it was especially cruel to do to her because 11 months previous, she had lost her parents to a murder-suicide. Her mother had shot her father, then shot herself, because her father had just told his wife that the last 15 years of marriage had been a lie, and he was with someone else, and he was moving on. And I actually have her final suicide notes, and she wasn't planning to take him out. She wrote suicide notes to him as well as other family members, and was planning just to kill herself, but then decided to kill him at the end. So my stepmother had just been through that, and then my dad also sent her flowers she received 3 days later on her birthday. But that story of my stepmother's parents, that's the one I'm exploring in Caribou Island. That's the true family story that's in the background. So it's been changed. I don't remember them clearly enough for them to be the characters, and it's been moved from California to Alaska, and a lot has been changed. But I like writing from a family story, a true story in the background, because that powers it emotionally, psychologically, and it powers it partly because there are these awful legacies. With my father, there was that legacy of doom, the legacy of shame. I also felt really guilty that I hadn't gone up there with him, the anger that I felt for a long time. Those are powerful, real experiences that give weight to the characters as I'm writing the fictions.
We're talking with David Vann about his novel Caribou Island. It tells the story of a family wrestling with the dark compulsions of its past and the breakdown of a marriage. And also, of course, the impact on the children. You have Rhoda's daughter here. She has a brother as well. They both relate to the fact of their parents dissolving marriage, to the dysfunction that obviously has been in that marriage from the beginning, really, in very different ways. Mm-hmm. How do the children here respond to their parents? How do you read them? And is there anything of yourself in them?
Well, Irene and Gary are the married couple, and Irene's the main character. And it's actually in Irene, not in their children, that you can find the closest parallel to my experience, because there's a second family story in the background here, which is that on my mother's side of the family, my grandmother walked in at age 10 and found her mother hanging from the rafters. And that's right in the first paragraph of the book, that's the background for Irene. So she has that long legacy of suicide in her background, which I hadn't written about before in Legend of a Suicide. That was about the closer legacy of the suicide. And this is a much longer 45-year legacy where she's tried to forget that moment for the last 45 years from when she was 10. And she's realizing now that that's a terrible thing, that she's lost her entire childhood and her past, and she's trying to recover it and trying to remember that.
And she says she had no mother. I mean, there's this, the abandonment theme is one that is, it, I think that, what am I trying to say here? That she, you're talking about Irene here, mm-hmm. her theme of abandonment is a very salient fact in this novel, Caribou Island, and her mm-hmm. daughter Rhoda, in some way, is trying to make up for that.
Right. Irene's abandonment is part of why she's willing to stay with this guy, Gary. She doesn't want to be left again. After her mother's death and her father leaving, she was passed around unwanted from family member to family member. And the last thing that she wants now is to ever be left again. And so it makes her more willing to stay in a bad marriage than she should be. She's trapped a bit. And her daughter is the one who would like to help her out of that. And her daughter's the one who's at risk of repeating the legacy again. But I think by the end, my sense of Rhoda is that she's strong enough that she won't continue this on. Her fiancé, Jim, is a real schmuck. And by the end, I think we have scenes where she's thinking that it's just an engagement. She could break it off. Why is she with this guy? And I think she'll move on into a much stronger life. But most of the novel is very frustrating for Rhoda, Irene's daughter, because she can't seem to reach her mother or help her mother out of this problem. And partly it's because the problem reaches back across Irene's entire life. And so Irene is becoming unreachable to her.
Yeah, it's a really powerful build-up, I think, in the character of Irene that you have. I mean, here's a woman who at first is terrified of being abandoned by her husband. She sticks by him, and then as they are out there building this place, they get into there's a storm. They get into some terrible weather. She gets a terrible headache. Mm-hmm. And this headache is a pivotal point in the book. Tell us what happens with it and what's its role in the development of this character, Irene.
The headache comes about, as you said, when they're out in a storm and they don't wear any rain gear because it would slow the work to go to the cab of the truck to get the rain gear. And there's a way in which they've been sort of punishing each other all the way along for too many years. If she were to pause in the work and go get the rain gear, it would be held against her later. And he wouldn't do it directly. It would be long enough removed in time he could pretend it's about something else. But he would be annoyed, and he would make that annoyance known and felt. And so she doesn't go for the rain gear. So she gets this awful, what starts is just a sinus headache, but it ends up being something that takes over and that doesn't have an explanation. She goes to doctors, and they can't find out what it is. She goes to a sinus specialist, and he can't find it even on a CT scan. So it becomes more who she is and a sense of pressure and weight and doom about her marriage and about her life. And it's modeled actually on 2-year-long headaches that I had that were really terrible, where I would walk around for days at a time unable to sleep and just moaning in pain. And it was a really awful and kind of life-changing experience. It's hard to see anything else clearly during that time. So there's a lot that puts pressure on Irene in this novel. They're out there in wilderness where there's no escape, no distraction, no help from anyone, and then they're cut off from everyone else. There's the weight of the marriage with Gary, the ways in which they've treated each other for so long that there's a kind of terrible momentum to that. There's this pain in her head that she can't get an explanation for and she can't get any relief from. You know, it's the pressure becomes worse and worse on Irene, and so I guess I should apologize to readers also for that. But it is tragedy, and it's trying to understand how someone can get to the point of no return, really, and of considering being willing to consider the possibility of killing your husband, how a woman could get to that point, because that's what I wanted to try to understand. That's what it had really experienced, had really happened in my family that we had experienced. And it was something that from the age of 11 when it happened, I never could fully understand, and I wanted to try to get as close as possible to understanding that. And so things get pretty fierce and pretty terrible to get to that point. But there are also other characters in the book, and there are some lighter moments that help break that up a bit for a reader. So we have Carl, a young guy who comes up who's kind of bumbling around, doesn't know what he's doing for fishing, and we have their son Mark, who's a commercial fisherman and pot smoker, and we go out fishing with him and in the canneries, and we get to see some of Alaska and take a little tour and get some lighter moments, and there's some humor with Monique and Jim.
And we should say who Monique and Jim are, because these were just some of the more trenchantly comic moments of the book. I mean, here you have Jim. Jim is Rhoda is Irene's daughter. Jim is her fiance, and take it away from there.
Yeah, Jim is he's really a light cameo role for my father, who broke up both marriages through infidelity. So what Jim becomes interested in more than his proposal to Rhoda and their marriage is Monique, who comes to town and is half his age. And to me, there's some funny moments there because he's just such a fool, and she plays him so well. There's one time when they're in the helicopter, and he's excited, and she has her hand on him and keeps him bent over in a U-shape in his underwear because it's very uncomfortable for him, and she finds that really funny. And she tries to kiss him through the helmets that they have in the helicopter, but her lips can't reach his, and so she's laughing at that also. And to me, it is laughable, his quest and his desire for her, and I had fun with that part. That the marriage between Irene and Gary, some of the aspects of Gary are grim and have consequences, but in Jim, it's much lighter. And it was fun to cast my father in that cameo role because he'd had such a heavy role in Legend of a Suicide leading up to his suicide, of course, in the book. But in this one, he could just be a kind of light philanderer. And I think that Rhoda she's slow to recognize what's going on, but I think she's strong enough to understand that she's not good for her, and I think she's going to move on and not be stuck in a life with him.
David Vann, in this novel, Caribou Island, you really inhabit the consciousness of your characters. It's written from varying points of view. It seems like it has a pretty jaundiced view of men in relationships and the women who enable them. What was it like to express those characters, to describe those characters from the inside?
I think I grew up with women, pretty much. I did spend a lot of time with my father and grandfather and uncle, but my father then killed himself when I was 13, and my grandfather, his response was to not talk with anyone and just kind of go silent and bitter. And I've had, on my other side of my family, my grandfather beat my grandmother, and I've had a lot of negative experiences with men in my family. And so I think that, combined with growing up with all women pretty much, and there were 11 single women in my family who all had plenty of complaints about men, I think that I always grew up pretty critical of men, and so it was strange for me to think about myself as a man and what that meant and who I would be. And so it actually came very naturally to write from Irene's point of view, from a woman's point of view here, and to have all of her criticism of Gary. And it was a surprise. I hadn't imagined that this book was going to be about marriage, actually, and I hadn't imagined I was going to be writing from her point of view. There's a lot that's out of control and unconscious about writing for me, and that's just where it ended up going. But I certainly felt very comfortable with all the criticism of men that's in the book, and that's how I really feel. And it was only after I'd finished the book that I realized that Irene's anger at Gary and her disappointment is actually my anger and disappointment at men, from my father and other men in my family also. So that was a strange thing to realize. I feel like I write and then I find out later what it was that was going on when I was working on the novel.
Yeah, and you know, since I usually don't ask authors about their personal life, but you have put so much of your personal life into your work. So now, how has it been having in some way worked through or found out some of your own feelings, kind of bared them for yourself? How has this worked out in your own relationships? I mean, you're married. You don't have children. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. Married without children. My wife, when she first read it, she did say, like, are we okay? Because it's pretty grim about marriage. And to me, the grimness goes beyond just marriage. There's also a problem of self in the book. Irene can't find a solid sense of self or a solid sense of her marriage, that both of those seem to be things that you assume are there and you rely on, and then when you really need them, when you go out to reach for them, you don't find anything. There's a disturbing way in which who she is now doesn't fit with 5 years ago and doesn't fit with 20 years ago or 30 years ago when she first met Gary. She can't get all the parts of her life to fit together and make sense and make one consistent, coherent story. And it's the same problem with her marriage. She can't get the marriage to all fit together and make sense, and she can't make a story to make it all okay and make it acceptable. And I think whenever a person hits that point, there's a real problem there. And so that kind of, to some degree, existential problem as well as a marriage problem is something certainly that I experience myself. I mean, my whole life, with spinning stories being so much at the center of my life, I've had a sense of how I guess constructed a sense of self is, and flimsy and unreliable, and so I've felt this kind of terror and anxiety myself, and so in writing about the marriage, it's very uncomfortable, because even though I'm very happily married and love my wife and we've been together 12 years and everything's been good and we've been faithful and we don't have the problems that Irene and Gary have, we get along well each day and we don't have the, you know, bitter moments that they have. Still, I've had, of course, those feelings of emptiness and loneliness and you know, that I think a lot of people experience.
Do you think that your ability to write it out in some way has protected you from repeating some of the patterns of your family?
I do. I think that it's wonderful to be able to live this second life through the fiction, and that a reader can experience that to some degree also, not just writers, that we live these other lives through books and we test those other lives and we go down other paths, and then in our real life we don't necessarily have to take that path anymore. And so that's a tremendously reassuring kind of experience to be able to have in fiction.
Well, David Vann, your book is Caribou Island. It was a powerful read. There were parts that were very, very funny, and then there were parts that were terribly tragic. And I think you're right. There was a sense in which I felt that you could express things that were really within all of us, and certainly within me, not the sense of wanting to commit suicide, but the way in which we have delusions about how our life is going to be, and then things turn out completely different. Mm-hmm. And then the moment when we figure out, oh, this is what's going on. Thanks so much for talking with us about this terrific book.
Thank you, and thank you for such excellent questions. I really enjoyed the conversation.
David Vann. You can read an excerpt from his novel Caribou Island at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests and see videos or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice. All one word. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.